Namaste. So we are starting a new series on Sanatana Dharma and modern issues. So we have already done a couple of talks which will get posted now subsequently. This becomes the first talk, like an introduction. The reason for this series is very simply that since the time human beings started living in groups, some kind of a society began to emerge. There has been a contemplation on how to create order, govern order in a society, especially with regard to maintaining the order, at the same time allowing freedom to the individual. This is the main issue around which social orders evolve. Because before social orders come into play, individual is like the solitary mastodon moving around, he's a law unto himself. But as society begins to form, there has to be an order. Everybody cannot live according to the way they want to live. And yet individual freedom is also important. That is how we look at it today. But it's good to understand that in different societies, different experiments have taken place, especially in Indian society, where we had what we know today as the Sanatana Dharma. And why it is relevant is because on one side we have today the democratic ideal, which wants to flatten society in terms of law, rules, and commonly we see law is equally applicable to all. Sounds almost like death saying law is equally applicable to all. But then when we say law is equally applicable to all, we don't keep in mind the extreme variation in human nature, stages of development, the diversity which we have to take into account. So in the Indian thought, something which is very amazing is that it allowed for this diversity. And we are not able to appreciate it, because sooner or later this is what is going to come up. Because if you don't allow for diversity and only have a flattened rational order, where there is the rule book and the constitution and the rule book as per the legislature, and according to that people are either punished or whatever sentence is given to them or judged according to that, we may create a kind of a ragtag order. But this order will not be able to sustain itself as society begins to become more and more diverse. So this is important to understand, that how different social groups have looked at life, at law, at rule, at liberty. Because we may pick up a lot of gems which are going to light us for the road to come in the future. Now, before the democratic, rational, scientific order came with its own rules and regulations, which today we are following, there was the religious law, and every religious group had its own law. For instance, in the law of Moses, which says eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, it's very interesting that this law is so much ingrained into the ethos that even though you have certain rules or framework of rules, for a person who has been brought up with that law, it tends to yet mold his thinking and his reactions. Similarly, in Islam, there was a set of rules, hadith. So how much ever you may rationalize, still it is something which runs into the fabric of a typical Muslim who believes in his religion and he wants to follow his life according to those edicts. Now, we are not discussing whether they are right or wrong. Similarly, in Christianity, you have a set of rules and regulations. At the same time, the whole purpose of democratic, rational society is that religious law is very imperfect. So we are going to give a more scientific, more rational, and thereby we are going to create a perfect society. Shubhendu speaks about it in Savitri, book 2, where he speaks about the little mind. And he says that this is how society will try to create a law, standardize things to a standardized perfection, but this too is going to break down. And we are beginning to see the breakdown. The democratic way of life, it is something very good, without a doubt. It has given its own beautiful fruits, and it has definitely helped to remove certain discrepancies, certain kinds of inadequacies of the religious law. Also, at the same time, this rational scientific order has given birth to another kind of problem. Its extreme tendencies in human nature have used it for certain kind of strong ideological leanings, which in turn begins to reflect upon the law. As we know today, that however much you may have a judge sitting there, he won't be having an impartial reason. He will be biased. He'll be biased according to this ideology or that ideology. So religion has been replaced by ideology. And now law is armed with ideology or backed by ideology, and ideology is armed by law. That creates a very difficult and peculiar situation. For instance, modern democratic law would say that you are innocent till proved guilty. It's very beautiful because it allows for a certain kind of compassion. It also says that, well, in some countries, that 10 persons who have done a wrong may go unpunished, but one who has not done something should not be punished. So these are the principles on which rules have been built. Also, it takes into consideration the constitution and all that the reason can create. But I think it's time to look beyond. Something new is coming, and this new has to apply for a lot of plasticity, wideness, individual liberty, at the same time equity, at the same time it has to take into account the social order. So one of the ancient systems which we have forgotten, and it's not ancient because it runs through the fabric of human consciousness, is Sanatana Dharma. Now why I say it's ancient and not ancient? Because it is not based on any artificial man-made or mind-made system. Mind-made systems are constructed by the mind. Whereas Sanatana Dharma took into account the deeper nature of human beings and all its diversity, stages, and therefore it has evolved many ways of life and laws and rules and regulations which can be applicable to a very diverse strand of human beings. And when we dwell into it, it's something amazing. So let me just share a little bit of it, because very often we hear nowadays words like Manusmriti. So, you know, people talk without knowing what Manusmriti is about, I must say. So what really is Manusmriti? Manusmriti is one of the earliest edicts of Hinduism, Hindu thought, or Sanatana Dharma, as to the rules and regulations that should govern society. Now people often say it's all about Brahminism, but let's examine what it contains. First of all, today what we know as Manusmriti is largely a additions which have come. Like constitution, there are plenty of amendments. So a lot of people kept adding to the original scripture. That apart, in its essence, what it contained is, he said there are four ways. It mainly speaks about dharma. So it says that dharma should be the basis of law. So it discusses four things. One is the source of creation. So you can't just have a law hanging in isolation without taking reference to the creator. For example, if I take into consideration that creation has emerged out of nothingness, or it's built by desire, then how much ever rules and regulations you may bring about, human nature will be ultimately, and that we see today, a rational order of society which has removed God. So what happens? There are many things. For instance, if you get unduly angry, if you abuse someone, blatant things like pornography, you have to think about making a law. These things are continuous undercurrent because, well, society is built on this idea that whether God exists or not, it has nothing to do with our everyday life. Whereas Sanatana Dharma tried to connect the divine with life. So first aspect of Manusmriti is the source of creation. Second is the source of dharma. So what is the source of dharma from which the laws have to be derived? How are we going to derive the laws? Is it by man-made rules, mind-made rules? So Sanatana Dharma, Manusmriti says no. So how are we going to find the laws and rules that should govern a society? So first it says the Vedas. So you have to refer back to the Vedas. What do they speak about human nature? What do they speak about the different systems? For example, very few people know that there are 8 kinds of marriages which the Vedas mention. And only 2 of them are regarded as null and void. Even if it has taken place, it's regarded as null and void. Whereas 6 types are considered as acceptable. Now, I'll just give an example. For instance, today we have those live in relationship. Do the Vedas sanction it or no? Now we see, when we go back to the Vedas, among the six types of marriages, one of them is called as Gandhar Viva. Vishwabindu speaks about it in Savitri, where the son is the witness. God is the witness. Parents are not consulted. Nobody knows about it, and yet you are married. And we see instances like in the story of King Dushyant, Shakuntala and many others, that this marriage was sanctified according to Vedas. You see how different our perspective changes. Equally, marriage of a girl from a lesser, we'll come to that caste, how it comes, caste denomination to a higher caste denomination was accepted, and not vice versa. So there were many aspects which are there in the Vedas, sanctity of marriage, how it, you know, what marriage meant. So there were many aspects in the Vedas which came from, so he says Vedas are the first Praman. So if Vedas have sanctified something, that is to be accepted. But again, not blindly, otherwise we would become like, you know, the blind followers of a textbook. So it incorporates another thing. Another thing is the way of life, conduct of those who have understood the Vedas and who have lived the Vedic lore. Now, you see, because Vedas' interpretation, understanding, each one would have his own understanding. So, follow the rishis. So, there are rishis who have understood, who have tried to live according to that, and they have set into motion certain traditions. So, those traditions have to be followed, which are set by rishis who have understood the Vedas. This is the second one. Then, third one is the actions of those who are holy. Now this is the third thing. They may not know the Vedas, but they are revered as there's a very nice saying in Hindi, Jat na poocho sadhu ki, pooch lijiyo gyan. Don't ask his caste, don't know whether he has learned the Vedas or not, but see the depth of his knowledge. So holy man was not somebody with a vermilion mark and wearing a, you know, a lungi or a dhoti, but a holy man was somebody who was filled with a kind of inner knowledge which he was seeking. He was goodness, he was compassion. So this was the third thing which was incorporated in the law. And the fourth thing, which is very, very surprising, and very few people talk about it, is called Atmatusti. What appeals to your inmost deeper self. If you see the translations, is absolutely poor. It says, whatever is pleasing to yourself. But Atma is not about that. So it also makes a provision that these three things are there, but what really appeals to your own innate psychic sense. All these things are already incorporated, allowing for a great degree of diversity. Then, as we know, it stratifies society into four social strata. Very often people use this argument that this is all about Brahminism, because maximum verses are about the Brahmins, how they should conduct themselves. Then next is the Kshatriyas. Between them, they cover 9/10. It's true. For the Vaishya, there are basically 8 verses which refer to the rules for the Vaishya, and for the Shudras too. Now, actually speaking, it is not Brahminism. It is the other way around, because the rules for a Brahmin were far too many. For example, a Brahmin could not marry again. It was unlike a Brahmin. He could not charge money for whatever he was giving to society. It was the society's obligation to support him. Because if he starts charging money, then he loses his Brahmanatva, he becomes a Vaishya. Also because knowledge cannot be put into a category of, it cannot be labeled that for this much dollar, that much of amount of rupees I am going to give a teaching. See how noble a wonderful thing it was. A Brahmin was supposed to remain clean inwardly and outwardly. He was supposed to lead the life of not of a rich man, neither a poor, but just enough to take care of himself. So now if you look at it, it's not really Brahminism. It's on the contrary, extreme degree of rules and regulations from a Brahmin. But in Kshatriya, we see there are other rules and regulations. Kshatriya could marry more than one person. He is a Rajasic person. He could fight a war. Brahmin was supposed to follow Ahimsa, not only in word and speech, but in actions. But Kshatriya, Brahmin could use Hinsa, but only in extreme cases. Otherwise, he was supposed to not to lift arms, that was given to Kshatriya, who had the warring impulses. So it catered for those who have extremely rajasic in nature, who have the warring impulses. So Indian society gave them a place, but with a code of conduct. So Kshatriya had their own code of conduct. You can't strike at night, you can't strike when without challenging the other person, so on and so forth. If he's unarmed, you can't attack a person, and so on and so forth. Then for Vaishyas, and as I said, for Sudra, the life could be absolutely licentious. So if you look at it like that, I mean, they could drink, they could do in many ways. So it understood that the social evolution takes place through these categories. And for this very reason, the Brahmin's word, he was given the highest place in the society, because he was not a Brahmin by birth. Not even just by his outer action, but by his temperament, soul predilection, his inner state, his inner austerities. So this is how it for each one, it gives a rule of living which they were not supposed to transgress. Now, if they transgress, then there were certain punishment. One of them was, we hear about outcast. So if a Brahmin behaved like a very, you know, un-Brahmin like, so he was to spend his time in the forest, like you are an outcast. This is how it practiced. Or he could do prayaschit. Or in an extreme case, there were things like death penalty, of course, we know that existed. So it was allowing for the differences in society. At the same time, in dharma itself, there was something very interesting, and it was called dharma rules in case of an emergency. So these were the normal way of life. But supposing there is a sudden emergency, apad dharma. So all these have to be kept in the background. And you have to act on the need of the moment, not spur of the moment, need of the moment. So that was incorporated in the system of law and jurisprudence. So when we look at this system, it had its own merits. Now, subtly it is gone. And good, because we are not living in those times and we have new challenges. I mean, for instance, he didn't write about what to do with the modern issues of the LGBT community. So, you know, they had their own. I mean, there are people who don't fall into either category. They are of a different nature altogether. Nations were not yet, you know, they didn't know problems of dissension like modern societies are facing. So it is gone. It's perfectly fine. But what we have done is, in Hindu societies, we replaced him with Raghunandan. Whereas actually we had earlier Parashar Smriti, Manu Smriti. Now none of these were regarded as absolute, because there was not just the Manu, they were Smritis. Smritis were not regarded as absolute. Shrutis, which was inspired hearing by the Rishis, that was absolute, that was Vedas. So that Vedas, Upanishads, the Gita, it could not be challenged. Their fundamentals could not be challenged. Whereas Smriti was, thus we have heard. So it was received through a number of sources and incorporated in the scriptures. And the purpose of law is very interesting. So the purpose of law in Manu Smriti, at the end, it discusses about rebirth and the law of karma. And it says the purpose of law is ultimately to help an individual gain moksha. So there was this idea of prayaschit. A better word I like is paschatap. You do a tapasya, which is in retrospect. So the idea of the law was very interesting. It was not just that a social order is maintained, but each individual and a group is given a maximum possibility to arrive at inner freedom. Moksha was that. So when we look at it that way, it's very interesting. And Sri Aurobindo, in one of his writings in 1910, he speaks about it. He says that the time has come. We have Manu Smriti, okay, has gone. We have tried to replace it with Raghunanda, it has gone. The democratic ideals and the rational way of life, its inadequacies are becoming evident. And while it may apply in the European context, though they are also beginning to become aware, it certainly doesn't apply to the Indian ethos and Indian sensibilities. So he says that something new has to evolve. Maybe we have it. And we have. Otherwise, I'll take it out from and read something which Sri Aurobindo has said. So here Sri Aurobindo says that there is a kind of rule of law which has evolved like a machinery. Whereas if a new age has to come, this machinery has to be replaced with something more plastic. The word we use as is liberal, but what really it means. So, Shubhendu says, in India, we were, if possible, attached, even more attached to machinery, all the more because we had ceased to understand the science of social mechanics and which they embodied. So this happened when we forgot the deeper essence and why things were being done. So we got attached to machinery, outer ritual, customs and tradition without understanding the science behind it. So he's comparing it with the European system. We attached a superstitious importance to maintaining our society exactly in the mold of the Shastras, while in reality that mold had been altered out of recognition centuries ago. So ancient Manusmriti was still based on, and that somewhere, if I'm not mistaken, it's BC, 3rd or 4th century BC. We quoted Parashar and Manu while we followed Raghunandan and custom. So Raghunandan, of course, we know is in Bengal. He is the one, I think his surname was Bhattacharya. He took from Manusmriti, gave it a completely modern rendering and understanding in the Indian context. The religious fiction was very much like the English superstition about the British constitution, which is supposed to be the same thing it was in the days of Lord Somers. But is really a thing Lord Somers would have stared at aghast as an unrecognizable democratic horror. So same thing, if Manu had to see what we have made of his smritis, he would be horrified. The cause is the same in both cases. A robust and tenacious society freely developing its machinery in response to its inner needs, while cherishing and preserving them. So society advances, and as it advances, new challenges are bound to come in. So how to incorporate that with, you know, this is a big problem which is going on. How to read now what people are doing mentally, they become aware of a challenge, they incorporate a clause. And for every clause that you incorporate, the lawyer finds a way to, overpass it. Why? Because the basis is missing. So what really is the fundamental basis of the law? In India, it was dharma. And in modern societies, to maintain order. But actually, it creates more disorder, ends up creating more disorder, as we can see. Englishmen and Hindus have been alike in their tenacious conservatism and their refusal to accept revolution, alike in their respect for law and the thing established, alike in their readiness to change rapidly and steadily if the innovator would only disguise from them the fact that they were changing. Now here Shubhendu is not comparing with other harder systems. So we must not draw conclusions. So if our social reformers had understood this Indian characteristic, they might have revolutionized our society with comparatively small friction. Now he brings, every samaj must have its shastra, written or unwritten. Where there is no social scripture, there is nonetheless a minute and rigid code of social laws binding men in their minutest actions. The etiquette of the European is no less binding than the minute scrupulosities of Manu or Raghunandan, and it is even more minute and scrupulous. So when we look at Raghunandan and many of them, they give a lot of emphasis on achar, vevar. You remember those days when, you know, if children didn't touch the feet of parents, it was regarded as something which is not done. So if you didn't get up in the morning and touch the feet of Mother Earth, or certain things like if you didn't take a bath before doing your puja, it was regarded as something not done. So many such things were there in society. And society everywhere is exacting, scrupulous, minute, pitiless in punishment of slight departures from its code, however absurd and unreasonable that code may be. But while in India the sanction is religious, in Europe it is social. In India, a man dreaded spiritual impurity. In Europe, he shrinks from the sneers and dislike of his class or his fellows. Social excommunication is always the ultimate penalty. So how beautifully Shubhendu brings these two aspects. And then he speaks about the need of change. But in Europe and India alike, we seem to stand on the threshold of a vast revolution, political, social, and religious. Whatever nation now is the first to solve the problems which are threatening to hammer governments. This is 100 years back, more than 100 years back. This writing is in 1910. So Sri Aurobindo is speaking of the challenges which are going to come up. For instance, euthanasia. Is it good or is it bad? Is it legal? It is illegal. Suicide. Good or bad? Drugs. There are societies, you will be surprised. Like if you go to the Dutch society, I was very surprised. So they have legalized many things. They think that by doing this, illegality will stop. That's correct, okay, because you have legalized it. If you legalize, for instance, flesh trade, it's considered alright. It's not called trade anymore. But the problem is that the society is taking a downhill, which is not given a consideration. Drugs, many drugs are being legalized today. So how do we have to look at these things? He speaks about a vast revolution. Whatever nation now is the first to solve the problem which are threatening to hammer governments, creeds, societies into pieces all the world over will lead the world in the age that is coming. And this was the... I had not read it when the series started. I read it long back. But maybe somewhere it was working in the background. Mother spoke of the psychic law which must govern in India, and the time has come to govern it. So what really is this psychic law? How we can look at modern problems in the light of this deeper truth which is already there with us, and see how it can be adapted to new circumstances, to new changes, to the evolving human consciousness. He is telling us that you can't just simply pick up from there and paste it here. Equally, you cannot pick up a European system and paste it here. So there is something new which has to evolve in the way of governing life, in the way of legislature, in the way of the rules and regulations which conduct our affairs. We'll lead the world that is coming. It is our ambition that India should be that nation, and for valid reasons, because India is the one nation which has allowed for extreme diversity. The fact that we have flourished as a diverse nation is itself is a proof. Now, nowadays, people speak about diversity. But are people really able to handle it? I mean, look at America, which has been such a champion of so-called diversity. Cannot handle the problem of blacks and whites. We know it. Even today, it's happening. In Europe. So, but India long back handled this diversity. So, there are very beautiful things which we can pick up. At least the core, the essence. And then we can develop upon it. But in order that she should be what we wish, it is necessary that she should be capable of unsparing revolution. She must have the courage of her past knowledge and the immensity of soul that will measure itself with her future. So this is where I felt we should have some reflections and deliberations on this issue, that based on the past knowledge and the expanding soul of man, we are not just the rishis of yore. we are rishis of the future, of modern India, where there are very different kinds of things which have come up. And yet that spirit is there within us. It runs in our veins. That knowledge, the Vedas, they are embedded within the collective psyche of the race. And we should see what it can yet give for the future. And as Sri Aurobindo has said, that it has a lot to give for the future. In fact, Sanatana Dharma will be the base for the future. So he says she must have the courage of her past knowledge that was so courageous to, you know. Nowadays, the problem is that many things secretly we cherish, but we are afraid of expressing because of the, again, what will be the public opinion. So there are many people who practice still in the obscurest way the caste system, not in its true method. But they will never speak about it, because to speak of caste is to be labeled as somebody who is backward. Whereas there is a aspect of caste which is inbuilt within the human fabric. At the same time, the caste system in its outward expression had to be broken. It is broken. It is very good. But we are throwing the baby with the bathwater. this what is happening. So when we look back at, for instance, a professional, I'll just take this small little example, Adhikar Bhed. So today we don't have that. So anybody can enroll in a university if he has the money and he can learn. So if the North Korean president wants to learn the latest nuclear technology, he has the right to learn. Then you can't stop him because he has the right to learn. Now, whereas when we look back into the ancient system, there was something known as Adhikar Bhed. And that is what is epitomized in the story of Eklavya, which in modern context we don't understand. Or even the story of Karna, that, you know, when Parshuram says, no, you are not the Adhikari for this kind of Vidya. Why he was so touchy about teaching only to Brahmins, though he has taught to Bhishma and Dronacharya. Because he wanted this knowledge to be in the control of those who were really had self-mastery. Because it would be devastating. But in Eklavya's story, as the story goes, that he shoots a lot of arrows at a barking dog and makes him quiet. He shuts him up. And when Dronacharya sees, he asks his thumb. And his reason, which we don't discuss, is that somebody who can fire a salvo of arrows at a dog who is barking is too dangerous to be given this kind of knowledge, which you have to use under the greatest restraint, which is what we see again, Ashwathama, who did not have the adhikar. Yet Dronacharya gave him the knowledge out of Putra Moh. And we see that toward the end, he does fire Brahmastra, which has to be checked. So this sense of Adhikar Bhed was there, which was something so important. So he says that she must have the courage of her past knowledge and immensity of soul that will measure itself with the future. This is impossible to England. It is not impossible to India. She has in her something demonic. Demonic is psychic, which is something not demonic, but D-A-E, the inner demon of Socrates. Something intuitive, something which can divine a deeper truth, something which is more psychic and inward oriented. She has in her something demonic, volcanic, elemental. We still can understand, get in touch with the primal roots of creation, elemental, the five tattvas. And at the same time, an Indian is capable of a revolution. We see so many stories of people who created revolutionary changes. And one such story which comes to my mind is the story of Rishi Mandavya. It deals with law. So as the story goes, but the law of karma, that apparently he is sitting in meditation when a bandit is running with, escaping with some gold which he has stolen from a king, king's palace. And the police are chasing him. Police means those fellows who was supposed to safeguard. And he sees Mandavya meditating and throws the jewelry there and runs away. The people who are chasing him see the gold lying by the side of this sage and they bring him to justice. Now you see, eyewitness accounts. He is closing his eyes. He may have just closed his eyes to escape the law and he is posing like a seer. So they just did something mechanically, took him. And the king, the moment he heard this, he passed a judgment. And the judgment was that they should be sentenced to one night imprisonment on which they were supposed to be on a bed of nails or arrows, sharp pointed arrows. Which is as good as death, unless somehow you figured out a way of bearing all that torture and pain. So Mandavi is subjected there, and when he comes morning time, when they go to take out the dead body or the injured body, they see that this fellow is alive and meditating. Now there is a commotion. They go and inform the king, and the king comes, and when he sees the sage, he falls at his feet. He says, I am so sorry that I did this to you. He says, who are you? He says, I am the king. He said, you can't punish me. He said, then what do you mean? Where are you going? He says, I am going to ask the creator that what kind of a law is this and why I had to go through this. Now this takes law to a different dimension, law of karma. And as the story goes, when he asks death, what kind of a law is this? So death tells him that, you know, so many births back you had pierced a butterfly with a nail and needle, and that pain has come back to your life in the form of a bed of nails. Says, what? A child piercing a butterfly's wings in ignorance has to suffer like this when he has grown into a sage? And then he says, with all my tapasya, I change this law. See, it's very interesting. Savitri is about changing the law. Law of death is all flat. Whereas the law of love is not, he says, certain things apply to you, death. But there are certain beings who have to escape the law. You have to grant that liberty. So there is this possibility of law evolving and changing. And India has had her own revolutionary moments and revolutionary seers who changed the law. We see Shri Krishna. He refuses to give 80% tax to Mathura. The most pragmatic level. In fact, he says the king must be dethroned, which was something unheard of. So they said, how are we going to do it? Because king is supposed to be an incarnation of Vishnu. But he does it and he revolutionizes the whole thing. Similarly, we see in the story of Chanakya. Now, they understood the truth behind it, that a king is supposed to be the incarnation of Vishnu. He has to follow certain code of Kshatriya. If he is not doing it, he doesn't have the right anymore to sit on the throne. So instead of going by the letter of the law, they followed its spirit. So here comes this last bit. She can rise above conventions. She can break through formalities and prejudices. So the whole purpose is to try to see many of these modern problems in the light of the Sanatan Dharma, which is Indian way of life as it has evolved, and how we can apply them to new situations, new problems, new issues in the modern context. And even many of those issues which are there, but for which we are not clear, because we often say we have a way of life. But what really a way of life means? So all this we will discuss as the series develops.